that everybody in this room believes in the reality of heaven. You do, yes. May I ask if you are absolutely convinced in the reality of hell, what say ye? Okay. Along with this verse 12 and the discussion of amoralism that we had, there is a new cult, and I say that with a small c, with tongue in cheek, that is circulating in Bible-believing evangelical camps. It's the chapter and verse crowd. Okay? The chapter and verse crowd. Typically, whenever a dogmatic assertion is made on any subject, there invariably will be somebody who will say, well, give me a chapter and a verse on that. And typically, people who require that are coming from a mindset that is dubious, or they maybe are defensive a bit. But they will require a chapter and a verse. And typically, Christian people get sucked into that that battle of proof texting. You can kill people with proof texts. You know, everybody's got a proof text for this and this and this and this and this. So you say to me tonight that you believe in hell. You have a Bible in your hands. Without looking in your dictionary or your concordance, give me a chapter and verse. Don't look in your concordance. Look anywhere from Genesis to Revelation in the text. Anywhere where your memory will lead you. Give me a chapter and a verse. Now, I thought I was going somewhere really stunning in the first session by asking a question. What is the one topic, the one subject that is alleged to be preached the least, taught about the littlest in Bible-believing churches, thinking that that would really put a snarl around everybody's thoughts? And right away somebody says, what?
Hell.
Oh, okay. Well, I would like to think not at Grace Baptist. I would hate to go back and check all the sermon archives. I would like to think that at least there's been some splatter about the subject over the course of the years, and from time to time where we sat on the subject and elaborated some, I would like to think that. But give me a chapter and a verse. A chapter and a verse. I mean, you say, was this practical? Well, if you're talking to somebody about the reality of heaven and the desire in your heart for them to go there, the consequence would be that if they fail to bow the knee to the Lord, they're going to hell. That person may say to you, well, you know, I've been doing some reading. There's a lot of really intellectually bright Bible-believing guys who hold prestigious chairs in theology departments in Bible-believing seminaries who say that all the language, like for example in the book of Revelation, is merely figurative and very, very basically tends just to illustrate that you can't really, whenever it talks about fire, it's not really literal fire. And we've, you know, think about C.S. Lewis, for one. He's been a leading proponent in the doctrine of a soft hell. Rob Bell, I think, has written a book, said, you know, love wins. There is no such place as hell. And another guy will say how much he thanks his parents for getting him hooked on C.S. Lewis's writings because he taught him about the fact that God ultimately isn't going to send anybody to a place called hell. I know. Now, can you give me a chapter and a verse? Would you read that verse for me? Okay, now. If that was the only verse in all of the scriptures that mentioned hell, would it be sufficient enough for you? Now, be honest about this. Don't tell me what you think I want to hear. Be honest about it. Would it be sufficient to ground you in the reality of hell? I mean, or would it simply bring you to the borderland where, okay, maybe I see that. Where else might you find, besides Revelation 20, verse 4? Another verse in Revelation. So we're going to put all of our stock in the book of Revelation, John's apocalyptic literature. In Luke where? What do it say? And what did he see there, this guy in hell? Who did he see? So is this place we call hell within arm's reach of the alternative? I mean, can people in hell see people in heaven? Huh? Paradise back then. Okay. Any other references? Any other references? Hell. Chapter and verse. If you were presenting your case before the Supreme Court and the judges on the high court look down at you at your little podium and they pepper you with questions about the reality of hell itself and ask for your scriptural warrant, and they are met with a long draft of silence, how persuasive do you think you would be making your argument? I mean, we do have at least two places in the Bible to talk about it. Book of Revelation, Book of Luke, Matthew. You find one in Matthew, Adele? I'll take whatever you got. Okay. So would you say that that's really literal fire there?
Yeah, fires will burn.
Huh? Okay, so we got three spots here. Matthew, Luke, Revelation. That's somewhere in the Gospels. Now it says, you know, the verse we looked at is, all things are lawful for me. And if that's true, as seen by some, then what's the point of a place called hell? Luke 13:28. What does that say, Pastor Hosh? Okay. Now, again, I say, yes. Would you get some reference? Okay. Now we're picking up speed. The evidence is mounting. We've got at least five good solid places where the word hell appears. Okay, so we could go on for a little bit on this. But let's just say, okay, we can present a textual case in the Scripture for the reality of hell. And the all-moralist will come back and he will cite his proof text. Sir? Well, he qualifies the thing in the verse. He says all things are lawful, but not all things are expedient. Okay, and then but the bottom line seems to be, as some would say, that I will not be brought under the power of any. So long as I am not addicted to any particular thing, things are lawful for me. So I'm thinking, well, what things could he be talking about? Well, we learned to study the Bible in context. Okay, the immediate context to be in. It's like dropping a stone in a puddle. And when you speak contextually, you're talking about the rippling effect and the ever-widening circle that impact makes. So you begin with the verses in front, verses beneath. You go to the chapter, to the book, and you go from one book to the other book with this premise that God never contradicts his own word anywhere in the Scripture. Any confusion or misunderstanding or misinterpretation is purely on us, not him. Our failure, not his. So when we look at like verse 9 in the context, we see things like fornication and idolatry, adultery, effeminates, abusers, thieves, drunkards, revilers, extortioners. And he says, now all things are lawful for me so long as I don't get addicted to any of that. Now does that sound sensible to you? But do you understand the reality of the premise that is made by many in fundamental Bible-believing churches right along that line? In reality, if you look in the context, what is Paul talking about? You come to the next verse, he talks about meat. Meat's for the belly. Okay, is he making a case for or against vegetarianism? Or, as they say, veganism? What's he doing? Is he making a case for like that? No, look, don't eat meat, just eat vegetables. If you look at it again, you widen the context of your study, and you come over a couple of more chapters, and you can see where he gives a full dress explanation of what he means, where he's talking about meat that is offered to idols, because some in the church then, and by way of principle even in the church today, would have viewed meat that had been offered to an idol as an offensive thing and would not have done it and would have chastised any of the other brothers they saw doing it. And Paul had to dig in and correct that. And basically teaches us this, that meats as like idols are nothing. But if you have a brother who is offended by it, love rules, and you have the liberty under the law of love to set aside your rights. And indeed you should, unless you be a stumbling block to that individual. That's the whole crust of this. But you can, you know this and I know this, you can go anywhere in the Bible, take any verse you like to justify any action that you wish or not. You can proof text your way right through your Christian life. Can do. Here's just one sample of that action. Over in chapter 9, the apostle says in verse 1 and in verse 19, I'm free from all men. I'm free. Now, as American Christians, we've been born and raised in a culture that we rightfully enjoy. We are independent folk. We're free. Okay? And we don't give that freedom up easy. We don't give our independence up, but grudgingly. So Paul says, I'm free from all men. I'm an adult. You're not going to tell me what I ought to do, when I ought to do it, how I ought to do it. It's up to me. And so even in Christian churches, Bible-believing churches, you have this island or fortress mentality where it says, I'm going to cling to the Baptist historical doctrine of soul liberty, and I'm going to cling to that thing so tightly that I'm not going to let anybody in to upset that whole cart. This decision is my call. You like it, you don't like it. You're happy or sad. Makes no difference. Says, I'm free from all men. But again, you examine what he says in the light of the context. And it's not teaching as the proof texter or the chapter and verser would have you think, where he seeks to extract something out of a place in the Bible to force his own eisegetical conclusions on the subject matter. Now, you believe in hell. You do. And you believe it because it's in the book. It says that that is the unfortunate, pathetic, and tragic end of all who deny Christ and who go to their doom as rebels. It occurred to me when I picked up our handbook. You know, that word does not appear in our doctrinal statement. Does not appear in our doctrinal statement. Now, we may equivocate. Lake of fire. Okay. But is hell the same as the lake of fire? Revelation seemed to imply that there's two different spots there. Taken out of one, put in the other. Now, we say, yes, we believe that doctrine, and it's a horrible thing to contemplate. And we may be absolutely orthodox, biblically accurate in our assertion that it is a reality. But what is the ultimate test of whether or not we are convinced of its reality? When does it lift up off the table of mere theory, theological or otherwise, or philosophical, and actually engage the soul? What is the real test of our conviction that such a place is the final destination of every rebel? And you better be convinced about the reality of it, yes? Now, we call that in our churches what? Witnessing, evangelism. I was telling Pastor Mrs. Hosh that in the concluding message last night, my wife will attest to this, and I think probably every soul who sat in the room and heard this would verify. The speaker up there, never heard him before, just met him for the first time. He concluded his message with a presentation out of personal experience wherein he illustrated hell and how he went about doing it and how he said it and reinforced it, literally for me etched that on my brain. I will probably never forget it so long as I have my brain intact and can remember. And basically, to make a long story short, he was relaying a time when he and his family were invited in some place they were ministering to go spelunking. Okay? I had to think for a minute about spelunking. I didn't know if it was up or if it was down. Basically, he said it was told him, when his initial reaction was he resisted it. He said, "My kids can go, I'm not going." Because he said, you got to be able to get your head and your body through sometimes a little space about this, and there's a technique to doing it. He said, if you want to practice, he said, it's like crawling under the church pews in a space about that big for a good period of time. And so he said that what he did was, after everybody went home from that particular meeting and all the lights were out, nobody knew it, but he was practicing in the church, crawling under the pews to see whether or not he was wanting to go. So finally he relented. Of course, they outfit him with a hat with a light on it. And he said, and he was very graphic, as only he could do, on how the guide would take him into these little tiny crevices. You look at these little crevices, how does a human being get through there? And he said, well, there's a way. He said, you got to get your head in there. He said, and once you commit your head in a certain way, you can't pull her back out, and you can't pivot it. You got to go through. And so they were going through all of this, and then finally they get down on their bellies, and they're trying to crawl through these little tiny holes, head first in through. Sometimes the hole's so small, you got to take your hat off, push it through the hole first, and get your head in under there, and drag yourself through. And while he's doing this, he's thinking, what in the world would happen if we had a medical emergency and we're halfway down in here? How would we get help? And all these thoughts are running through his mind, and he said, this went on for a while. And finally, they break into this room, where it was a giant room where they could stand all up. They stood all up. It was a marvelous place. And the guy said, oh, look, just sit down and rest a little bit. So everybody sat down. And after they were sitting there for a little bit and everybody got their breath, he said, I want you to turn your lights out. And everybody turned their lights out. And he said, my first reaction was I brought my hand up to my face like this. And I could not see my hand. It was totally silent. Nobody could see anything. There was no light. And then the guide began to speak, and he said, you could sit here for the next 1,000 years and try to see your hand in front of your face and never see it. And he said, and the mind in a situation like that begins to be overactive, and he starts asking all kind of, internally you're asking all kind of questions. What if? So after a period of time, he said the guide had him turn the lights on, and he gave him a choice. He said, look, if we go this way, there's the exit. If we go this way, we're down another half hour through more holes and tunnels and stuff. He says, we're going to the exit. So they all bailed out the exit. He said, and when he and the rest of them got to the exit, he said he'll never forget what it was like to come in to the marvelous light and how he rejoiced for the light. And then he applied this truth. He said, it says in scriptures that all those who finally reach this place called hell, said to be outer darkness, where there is not loss of memory nor consciousness, but apparently neither is there much of anything else, to endure forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And that's the reality of it. Now, he said it in a way that I can't. He experienced the spelunking, which Dan would never even think about doing. That would never happen. That isn't going to happen. His body's too big to be dragging through little holes. I wouldn't do it anyhow. No. But it was graphic. And so I urge this upon you. If in your own heart and mind you're absolutely positively convinced that there hell is a reality and that it's going to be populated by people, and in some cases maybe by people that you know right now that you love, and the very thought of that prospect on their behalf brings tears to your heart and weighs the heart down, brings tears to the eyes, then go test the reality of your conviction by doing the only thing that you can possibly do. The only thing. You can't argue them into the kingdom. You can't doctrinally browbeat them into the kingdom. All you can do is tell them what Jesus Christ has done for you and what you wish he would do for them. And go from there. If you really believe that hell is a reality. Do you have any comments or questions of your own? Thank you for your kind attention.